morning, sir.
Call the Transportation Committee to order. And could I ask to have Martin Loring and Roger Martin, please? Martin, my instructions from Roger to you was that you're supposed to hold it to 15 minutes, or he's going to start kicking your shins.
Mr. Chair, I thought it would be age and beauty before the bureaucrat. Good morning, Chair Brown, committee members, staff. I'm Martin Loring, manager of the Public Transit Division of the Oregon Department of Transportation. The presentation I'm providing you with this morning to give an overview of the Public Transit Division. It's in the form of some PowerPoint slides to which I'll speak. I remind you again that the mission of the department is to provide a safe, efficient transportation system supporting economic opportunity and livable communities for Oregonians. The Public Transit Division is the smallest of ODOT's nine divisions in terms of staffing, with a proposed staffing level of 14 people and a budget of about $45 million for the biennium. Unlike some of the divisions, which actually own infrastructure, roads and bridges, trains, train track, and other divisions that are regulatory agencies like Motor Carrier and DMV, the Public Transit Division is essentially a grant shop. We provide funding assistance, federal and state funding assistance, and technical assistance and support to local government agencies and not-for-profit companies that deliver transportation services to the people who need them. The vision that we have to serve ODOT's mission is that the people who need this public transportation, particularly the elderly and disabled, that need this transportation to live a high quality of life, have adequate transportation available to them so that they can live independently and be gainfully employed. And that people who have other options, that is to say they can drive, but choose to ride public transportation, have sufficient options so that they can get where they need to go when they need to get there. We work with local governments in each of Oregon's 36 counties and some 200 providers, not-for-profit providers of transportation service in Oregon. The work that we do supports three benchmarks. I'm referring to the fourth slide now. The first benchmark is number 58, to help the elderly in Oregon live independently. The second Oregon benchmark is number 59, that relates to disabled Oregonians who can work, being able to work. And the third is benchmark number 70, to reduce one person commuting to and from work. We measure a lot of variables relating to our effort to see if we're successful or not, such things as rides per person, the condition of the fleet that we finance through grants, the number of communities that have intercity passenger service, how long it takes us to process payment requests and grant agreements, and how satisfied our customers are. Most of the work that we do relates to two of the department's goals. Goal number three, which relates to the livability of Oregon, and goal number four, which is to provide good customer service. I know this isn't a Ways and Means Subcommittee, but a brief overview of the proposed governor's balanced budget recommendation is on the next page. As I mentioned, it comprises about $45.5 million spread across five program areas. Transportation services for the elderly and disabled is by far the largest piece of the budget. Some 70% of the resources are right at $32 million. Transportation for the general public in small cities, that is to say cities under 50,000 in rural areas, is the next largest program, about 25% of the budget, $11 million.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. May I just ask how this number relates to the original 0103 budget and the final 0103 budget? Just the gross number, the 45.6.
Chair Brown, Representative Greenlick, it is less by $185,737.
That's approximately.
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
And that, we have an intercity passenger program. It's about 2% of the budget, $1 million. A transportation demand management program. This is helping people find alternatives that reduce travel during peak periods. These alternatives include sharing rides, telecommuting, van pools, carpools, that sort of thing. And then we also have a small transit planning program, about $1 million. The three small programs are essentially one-person programs in terms of ODOT staffing, and the two larger programs occupy most of our 14-person staff. Cutting the numbers another way, 93% of the $45.6 million in the proposed budget is comprised of what are called special payments. That is to say, money that flows through in grants to the local governments and private not-for-profits. 5% or $2 million is personal services. 2%, another million, is services and supplies, and there's no capital outlay in the budget. What are we doing with this money? The next slide is a little bit busy, for which I apologize, but it has some useful information on it. The bars that are going up track the growth in the population of Oregonians 60 years of age or older. And that cohort, as the demographers call it, is increasing. The line shows the number of rides per person, per elderly and disabled Oregonian, that we've been able to provide with the resources available to us. And it shows that essentially from 1992 through 99, we had a low level of a low and static level of resources. Obviously, as the population increased, the number of rides per capita went down. Starting in the 99, the legislature and the governor saw fit to increase resources, so we've been able to increase rides and rides per capita. And then the projection from 02 through 05 shows that with stable resources, the population continues to grow, there will be fewer rides per person. The next slide that has sort of those cylinders, page 7, is the number of annual rides that we've been able to deliver to the elderly, disabled, and general public in small cities, up to 5.5 million for this year. One of the important things we track is the size and the condition of the fleet that the Department of Transportation funds to serve the transportation needs of the elderly and disabled. This is on page 8. It shows that in 1998, there were a total of 404 vehicles, of which 67%, or 274, were in fair or better condition. By this year, by 2002, the year we just left, the fleet serving the elderly and disabled in Oregon had been increased to 683, a 70% increase, of which 83% were in fair or better condition. Our goal in this area is to try our best to make that fleet in 80% fair or better condition. The next slide deals with general public transportation. We work with communities in Oregon. This is a federal grant program. We've got about 5 people working in various aspects of general public transportation to provide vehicles and operating support to the smaller communities that want to provide public transportation services. That number of small communities has increased from 29 to 40 over the past 5 years, and they are working in most parts of the state. The number of rides these small cities delivered through their bus fleets has risen from 1.3 million to 2.3 million in 2001. And this increase, 60% ridership increase that we've experienced in Oregon, is almost double the experience at the national level. a small part of our general public program involves intercity passenger transportation. And in the policy adopted by the Oregon Transportation Commission as part of the Oregon Transportation Plan, the goal is that in every Oregon community of 2,500 or larger, people living there ought to have an option to get to the next largest market economy, the next largest community, and back in the same day. And we initially set the goal to have 78% of Oregon communities of 2,500 or more meet this goal by 2005. We've been fortunate in reality today, or 2002, we've already exceeded that goal. Some 90% of Oregon communities of that size have intercity passenger service, and we help support that. There are 106 communities in that size range. 96 meet the goal, 10 do not. We'll adjust the goal, and perhaps we can get to the 100%. The next slide deals with our transportation demand management program. This is the one area in which we're involved where we don't have any direct grant support in the division's budget. We have one staff person who works with regional rideshare coordinators around the state, works with our ODOT regional staff, transportation planners, and others to promote a wide range of voluntary alternatives to driving alone. These measures taken together have the potential to reduce congestion, save energy, and decrease air pollution. We're working actively in five communities at the present time. Our planning program, covered on page 12, is also a one-person program. We administer the state receives some federal grant funds to do statewide transit planning, and there is a companion document to the Oregon Transportation Plan dealing with public transportation planning, and it's our job to staff that update in conjunction with the planning folks at ODOT. And we also administer a source of federal grant funds for the six metropolitan planning organizations around the state that have been recognized by the federal government and the governor. There are, of the six, three of them are what are called MPOs, or metropolitan planning organizations, from 50,000 to 200,000 population. And then there are three that are the bigger MPOs. They're called transportation management areas, or TMAs. They're over 200,000 population. The Metro for the Portland area has been in that category for a long time. Under the last census, the Eugene-Springfield area, where the Lane Council of Governments is the MPO, got over that size threshold, as did the Salem area, where Mid-Willamette Valley Council of Governments does the staff work. And the amount of planning funds we transfer is provided on that chart. I'd like to briefly mention two initiatives in which the department and the division are engaged. One is something called the Transportation Coordination Initiative. This is something started by the former governor, actually before I was hired to ODOT 4 years ago. It recognizes the fact that a lot of different state agencies spend money on transportation. Slide 14 has a little pie chart that, to the best of our calculations, various state agencies spend about $180 million a year on transportation of one form or the other. The approximately $22.5 million that we spend supporting transportation around the state is less than the $32 million a year that the Department of Human Services spends to transport its clients to medically necessary non-emergency care. Corrections, employment, housing have very, very little programs in the aggregate. There's several hundred thousand dollars. The largest piece spent on transportation is the Department of Education's investment in pupil transportation, some $130 million or so a year. You throw that all together, it's a pretty big pot of money, and the notion that Governor Kitzhaber had, that Governor Kulongowski is reviewing, is that when you're spending that kind of money, you really need to look at how you're spending it to see if there's anything that you can do to coordinate service, save money, get more bang for the substantial number of dollars that are being invested. We are working with as a group of 8 state agencies to try to find those ways to wring more bang out of the ever more precious bucks that we're investing in transportation. And we
Mr. Chair,
hope that that initiative continues.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding education there, we have mandates, I understand, that require school districts to go pick up kids with the school buses. And I've heard rumors that, like in Wheeler County, we'll send a bus 40 miles to pick up one student. Could we eliminate some of those mandates and maybe cut this pie down a little bit here on the education part or save some money there? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Chair Brown, Representative Zahner, a lot is possible. In the case of, I mean, the example that you give in Wheeler County, just not sending the bus, there's probably not a public transportation bus that could take that child. There are a lot of mandates. They're not uniformly the same across the state. Just by way of example, in Portland and Eugene, the school districts aren't mandated to transport high school kids, and I don't think junior high kids. Those students take the public buses, and there's a good transportation system in place that saves the district money. This is a complex problem for which there aren't simple solutions, but we're actively engaged trying to get the Department of Transportation director together with the brand new superintendent of the Department of Education. We're looking at a lot of options, and there are mandates. There are a lot of mandates in these areas. Part of the coordination initiative is looking at those and see which of them make sense. School buses have different standards than public transportation buses. Who's right? Do we need 2 different sets of standards? We're looking at a lot of things and hope to make a lot of small baby step improvements that, in the end, make for a much more efficient and effective system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The other initiative is a bill that the department asked to have introduced. That's Senate Bill 180. This bill, if passed, would amend the major state transportation funding program administered by the department. That's the elderly and that's capital funding for the elderly and disabled. Currently, that statute works through what are called governing bodies. It's essentially a local program. The state grants the funds to governing bodies in each of the 36 counties. By statute, those governing bodies are transportation districts or mass transit districts. Where they exist and where they're in counties where there isn't a mass transit district or a transportation district, the governing body is the County Board of Commissioners. This works fine, but last session the legislature passed a bill called Senate Bill 770. It's a government-to-government initiative saying that state agencies should look at the way we deal with federally recognized Indian tribal governments as sovereign entities. And we reviewed this program and determined that asking a tribal government to go through a transit district or a county board of commissioners to get access to these funds is not in keeping with the public policy goals set out in the government-to-government initiative, and it would be better if tribes were dealt with on an equal footing, like counties and transportation districts. And if Senate Bill 180 were to pass, it would recognize those tribal governments on the same basis.
Mr. Chair, I have a question regarding that. So currently you're saying that the money has to be allocated through ODOT to the tribes. Is that correct?
Chair Brown, Representative Dingfelder, no. Currently it's allocated by ODOT to governing bodies. Governing bodies, in the Wheeler County example, Representative Zahner used, it's the County Court, the Board of Commissioners, that's the governing body. They have a committee that works with them. They decide where that money is going to go, send in an application, we send them the money. Forgive my ignorance. I don't know if there's a tribe that's in Wheeler County. But if there were, that tribe could seek funds, but they'd have to go through the county board to get the money.
Just follow up. This would allocate the money directly to the tribes as a governing body themselves.
On the same basis.
Body themselves.
Chair Brown, Representative Dingfelder, okay. Yes.
And just a quick follow-up on that. Do tribes provide their own, do some tribes have their own transportation systems?
Representative Chair Brown, Representative Dingfelder, yes. Some do. There are 9 federally recognized Indian tribal governments in Oregon, and there's only a couple that are doing much in this area right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Transit Association. That's an organization formed 24 years ago by both the fixed route operators and what we call the senior and disabled transporters. I was fortunate to be picked as the executive director, and they've never been able to get rid of me. And I've appeared before a number of these committees. I want to briefly give you kind of a little historical perspective on public transportation. We have 20 fixed route providers in the state of Oregon. Those are people that run bus systems on a regular route with a time schedule and those kind of things. They go from TriMet in the north, Rogue Valley Transportation in Medford, Klamath Basin, Basin Transit in Klamath Falls, and several cities. We also have about 30 people in this state, 29 I believe, that are providers of senior and disabled transportation. Those are specialty people that either run a dial-a-ride system where a senior can call in and ask for a ride and someone will go out and pick them up, or some form of a fixed schedule, but they do it on a demand system. They serve all the counties in Oregon, but especially they're the only transportation available in the smaller systems in Oregon. I mean, in the smaller counties in Oregon. And the answer to Representative Dingfelder's question, I'll just give you an example. I happen to represent the Umatilla Indian Reservation, and they have their own bus. And the county gets money, which they spend entirely on a contract with a bus, with a taxi system for the seniors. So there's no money exchanged with the tribe. The tribe is supplying 100% of their own financing to run their own bus. Their need is that the reservation headquarters of the Umatillas is 7 or 8 miles outside of Pendleton. There are a number of people that need rides to either education or to work, and the tribe is supplying that without any help from the state. Not that there's something evil about Umatilla County, but it just didn't seem to work out, and it's one of the reasons behind what the effort will be. Public transportation in Oregon, and there's kind of an urban myth that goes on, and I want to help to dispel part of that. Public fixed route providers provided 102 million rides in last year in the state of Oregon. That's an increase of 100% in the last 20 years. Public transportation has doubled in the last 20 years. And in some communities, Medford, where Representative Gilman is, the area he's from, have actually gone up at a faster rate than that. TriMet, the largest provider, fixed route provider in the state, has averaged, and I just want you to listen to this for a minute, has averaged 5% increase for 115 months out of the last 116 months. That's nearly 12 straight years of increase, because there are a lot of people that say, well, you know, nobody rides it. The old syndrome about they see a bus with only 2 people on board, therefore nobody's using it. TriMet is reaching in the community. 44% of everybody that lives in the metropolitan area rides that bus. There's a recognition, I think, by the state and public transportation. By the way, I said that Jeff Hamm, in my testimony, was the general manager of Salem Area Transit, was going to join me. His main job is to run the system here in Salem, and he has an important, critical meeting with a supplier out of town today and couldn't be here. He will be here before you, hopefully in the future. During peak hours, and another example, Eugene and Salem and Portland have the often critical traffic problems. During peak hours, whole lanes of the freeway in the metropolitan areas are relieved by the service of bus. The light rail system in Washington County from downtown Portland to Hillsboro takes off 1.5 lanes of traffic off the most crowded road in the state of Oregon, Highway 26, Sunset Corridor. I have to travel that occasionally, and it's utterly amazing to me the jam of traffic that's there. And I only want to say, if it weren't for the light rail, you can't believe how much worse it would be. On ramps, and the amazing thing about Highway 26 is it's bad in both directions, and it's bad 7 days a week. I've come back on a Sunday afternoon coming from the west going east into downtown Portland and run into traffic that is standstill bumper to bumper for a mile or more on the Sunset. During the peak hours, the Sunset, the on-ramps take sometimes 20 minutes for people to get to the end of the line and progress their way up to the traffic light that will let you on the road to start with. We do have in the state of Oregon some severe problems, and I'm only trying to make a point that there is a key role played by transit in relieving that traffic jam. And I say that because I want you to know the Oregon Transit Association is one of the strongest supporters of whatever you're going to do to increase funding for highways, for the streets and roads of Oregon, because we use those streets and roads. We need good streets and roads, and we've always supported whatever the gas tax increase or whatever package. None of that, as most of you know, none of the gas tax by constitution in Oregon goes to supply us with any money. We support it. I find it kind of ironic that some of our partners in that effort will kind of under the breath say to you, they subsidize public transit. You know, you don't want to give any money to public transit to subsidize. I think there's a point that needs to be, they don't happen to go on to say that there's no form of transportation I know of that is not subsidized by government. How do you think our airline system got to be what it is today without public subsidy, part of which was the Second World War when they developed large long-distance planes? But we put millions of dollars into airports, airport service. We do the same for rail, not as much for rail anymore. We still try to subsidize it. And I don't know how anybody that promotes automobiles only can understand that we don't massively subsidize the use of automobiles in this country. If for no other reason, just take the land occupied by I-5, I-205, and 405 in Portland and tell me what the value of that land would be if it were not used for public purposes and it was on private rolls and taxed. So I just find that I had to get that off my chest. The origins of public transportation in Oregon date to an interim committee that I chaired many years ago during the 1969-70 interim when I was a member of the Oregon House of Representatives, called the Interim Committee on Urban Affairs and Mass Transportation. And we came up with a number of the laws that eventually passed in law in recognition of the fact that private bus systems were gone. The best story I know on that was in the late 1960s, the man that owned the private bus system in Eugene walked in on a Friday night to the city manager's desk, and I happen to know the city manager. I knew him. He's not alive any longer. And dropped a big bundle of keys on his desk and says, "Here are the keys to your new bus system." And he said, well, the manager said, "What do you mean?" He says, "I'm out of business." He had taken what had been almost a 100 bus route and cannibalized it down, borrowing parts from one vehicle to make down to about 20 operating vehicles that were barely operating, and he was going broke. He could not operate alone. He dropped the keys on the desk of City Eugene. The city ran it for a brief period of time, and then Lane Transit District was formed. The several kinds of, and I won't go into all the details, I've talked to some in the past, but there are three transit systems in the state of Oregon. Two of them, Eugene and Portland, charge a payroll tax. And I bring that subject up because one of the issues you will be asked to consider this year is an increase of 0.1% in the authorized amount that those districts, you won't have to vote on the tax, you're simply changing the authorization to allow them to increase their payroll tax in those areas. All the other public systems, and there are a number of transportation districts, operate on a property tax. All of those are limited by the variety of things that have happened on our tax system over the last number of years. I think it's important that you know, though, the state of Oregon, which has been friendly to public transportation, has authorized it, has not been overly generous in the amount of money we give. The state of Oregon gives about 6% of the overall cost of operating transportation. That compares to 18% nationwide. The other 49 states average 18%, or three times what we do. And as a matter of fact, our neighboring states of Washington and California give over 20% to the operation of their local bus systems.
Roger, is there any of the gas tax goes into the transit system other than providing the road for them to run on?
Not in Oregon, no, Mr. Chairman, no, not in Oregon. It has in the past in the state of Washington, and if you remember, there was a ballot measure there just recently that eliminated their opportunity to use any portion of the gas tax. California And I have to be fair, I'd mention that both California and Washington have a sales tax, which has allowed transit systems to increase the local sales tax by a percentage. I don't think I'll live long enough to see that opportunity in Oregon, so I'll leave that out. You need to know that the state does, and I mentioned last week when I testified, we have an in lieu of payroll tax that the state contributes. That dates to the to when Governor Attia brought that to the legislature some 20 years ago. And there's a trade-off in that. It's here in Salem, which has the largest number of state employees, and therefore the subsidy of the Salem Area Transit is larger than it is in total dollars than it is in other communities in the state. There was a trade-off. When that happened, the state legislature did not have to build a massive parking lot for state employees. The plan at the time, that had already been approved by the Capital Planning Commission, was to take the entire park on our towards our west here, take everything down, build a two-story garage, and then do as they've done across the street, replant the park. Well, the trees wouldn't be there, but replant the park. And we did not have to do that when we went to the in lieu of payroll, and the Salem Area Transit carries a sizable number of public employees. We also have in this state the recognition of the need for helping the senior and disabled, elderly and disabled. 1 cent cigarette tax was passed in 1985, and another 1 cent was added to that in 1989. So there are 2 cents of the overall cigarette tax go to senior, elderly and disabled transportation. The legislature did recognize, and there was a committee chaired by former Governor Goldschmidt, appointed in the mid-90s by the former governor, to study transportation, and they came back with one criteria, that the role of the state of Oregon was recognized to be for elderly and disabled, not for the rest of transportation. We felt at the time that was a mistake. We didn't argue because we were all trying to get some form of funding passed. Most funding didn't pass. But we do think, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that the state of Oregon should seriously consider officially stating that you do have a role in the provide of the regular route, the fixed route transporters in the state of Oregon. And I think that might even be in the form of some piece of legislation just saying we may not have the money right now, and all of us know we're going to be very short this session, but we may well be able to, in future years, find a way to pay. And the reason that that's very important is that the federal government still continues to appropriate sizable amounts of money for capital grants, not for operating, not for operations, but for capital. Most of our systems get 80% of their money for replacement buses from the federal government, but many of them don't have the 20% match needed. And we feel strongly that the state should consider setting up a bus replacement fund, and we can use that to match the 20%, and it may, unfortunately, the federal government may change that formula to 50-50, but it would be very helpful, especially to the smaller communities, to be if they had that money available to them. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate very much the opportunity of being here. We want to work with all of you. We will be very happy to give you further information. I didn't want to inundate you with facts and figures. And I want you to know we work very closely with Martin Loring and the Transit Division. Unlike some other forms of transportation, we have not had any arguments with the Public Transit Division. They're vital to us, and we hope we are to them. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Roger. Is there any questions or either of these?
May I just comment,
yes,
sir?
Certainly.
To update the story about nobody rides the transit in Washington County, the story is nobody rides MAX because it's too crowded. But I do want to appreciate and note your comments on MAX in Washington County, which really is very vital, I think, to the needs of my district, and we hope we'll have some ways to make sure that continues to improve its ability to serve both the passengers and perhaps to serve industry there in a different way.
Any other questions? No, thank you, gentlemen, for
thank
coming
you.
This morning.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
We appreciate it.
Yeah.
comment. The next person I'd call would be Bob Russell with the Oregon Truckers Association. Trucking Association.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Association, and with me today is Al Elkins from the Oregon Tow Truck Association and Dee Bridges from the Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association. Between the three of us, we are trucks, and we travel in a pack. So we're here to give you an overview about the trucking industry this morning. What I'd like to do is sort of have a conversation with you. We're going to give you some information, but we'd like you to feel free to ask questions as we go along this morning. I want to make sure that you understand the issues of the trucking industry and where we might come from as you go through your deliberations throughout the session. The trucking industry here in Oregon, there's 8,712 trucking companies that are actually located in Oregon. And these folks operate 47,122 trucks. But that's only part of the story. There's 16,813 trucking companies that are located outside of Oregon that operate in and through Oregon. These folks operate almost 250,000 trucks. Nationally, there are about 500,000 trucking companies, and they run about 2.6 million heavy trucks. In the year 2000, the trucking industry employed 112,560 Oregonians, and we paid about $3.8 billion in wages. We represent about one in every 20 jobs, or 7% of the total payroll of the state. The average wage was $34,004. These are family wage jobs. They're good jobs. So our direct contribution to Oregon's economy as an industry is significant, but it doesn't in any way describe our impact on the economy. And because of what we do, we are in fact the engine that makes Oregon's economy and the nation's economy work. You're going to hear a report from the Department of Transportation in a week or two on Oregon's bridges. And part of that study that they did was an analysis of the significance of the trucking industry to Oregon's economy and what you might expect if the bridges were restricted. One of the conclusions that they came up with is that 70% of the total freight tons that are generated in Oregon are moved by truck. And that's very consistent with the national numbers. Right,
That's generated within the state, but that doesn't include intrastate traveling through the state?
Mr. Chairman, that is absolutely correct. It's 70% of the tons that are generated by Oregon's economy. And when you look at the statistics nationally, it's between 68 and 69% of the total tons nationally are transported by the trucking industry. Generally speaking, those states in the West are more reliant on trucking than the states in the East. So you would expect the numbers for Oregon to be higher than the national averages. If you switch that around from tons to dollars, 85 cents of every dollar spent on freight transportation in this country is earned by the trucking industry. So what those two mean is that we are the mode of choice. We obviously transport far more freight than any other mode, but we're also fairly expensive and compared to the other modes, particularly rail and water and pipeline. Air freight obviously is more expensive than trucking, but its percentage of the total in terms of tons is relatively small.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Honor.
Bob, is it they're willing to pay more price because of convenience of getting it there more rapidly or quicker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, service certainly is an issue, and the way we deal with transportation, freight transportation in this country has certainly changed in the last couple of decades for a number of reasons. But yes, it is primarily service that people are paying for, and when you think of just-in-time delivery systems and all of those kinds of things, service becomes a priority for our customers.
Thank
you, Bob. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The Federal Highway Administration has recently released their 2020 forecast for transportation. And what they're seeing is they expect that there will be a doubling in the transportation of freight nationwide by 2020. However, they came out to Portland and gave a presentation about 6 weeks ago, and they indicated that they expect that freight transportation in the Portland metro area are generated through the port and by the industry located in Oregon is going to actually quadruple. So we're looking forward to much greater pool of freight in this state that we have to figure out a way to deal with by 2020. They're also forecasting that trucking share of that increase is going to be even greater than our share today, so that we're going to be continually reliant on the trucking industry to get our goods to market. You can see that when we say, if you've got it, a truck brought it, that's nearly always true. Although we are a very large industry, like a lot of industries in today's economy, we are suffering. We're suffering because of the economy, but also because of a number of factors that are somewhat unique to trucking. In the last 2 years alone, there have been 9,000 trucking companies that have gone bankrupt. Now, this doesn't include the ones that have just closed their doors or have merged with other companies. Our industry is going through a severe contraction at the present time. There are some specific issues that are impacting us. September 11th had an impact on insurance costs, generally speaking, for all of business. Transportation was hit particularly hard because there's a recognition that a terrorist could use transportation equipment to create a terrorist act. On the average, and we did a nationwide study, on the average, public liability insurance in our industry, if you renewed after September 11th, went up 37%. Insurance is the trucking industry's third largest cost: labor, fuel, and insurance. Those are huge increases. Umbrella insurance, on the average, increased by 120%. That's if it's available. A lot of our companies are no longer able to obtain umbrellas over $1 million, particularly in that $2 million to $5 million range. It's just not there. Some companies have experienced increases as much as 1,000% in their umbrella insurance, which is just huge. Some of you may be aware that October 1 of 2002 was the deadline for new diesel engines. And these new diesel engines have additional pollution control equipment on them. They're costing our industry between $3,000 and $4,500 per engine to purchase. But maintenance costs are also higher on the new engines, and fuel economy is down. So the overall cost is fairly significant. One of our largest costs, our second largest cost, is diesel fuel. And fuel has been very volatile in the recent past. A week before last, diesel fuel nationwide hit $1.50 a gallon. It wasn't that long ago that diesel was running around $1 a gallon. That 50-cent increase, if you figure we get 5 miles to the gallon, that adds 10 cents per mile to our costs. The truckload sector, the guys that are hauling the big shipments around, their revenue averages $1 to $1.20 a mile. So if you increase and their cost by 10 cents a mile, and their average profits are between 3 and 5 cents a mile, you can see what happens to those trucking companies. We actually chart diesel fuel prices with bankruptcies, and they just parallel one right with another. As diesel fuel goes up, trucking companies go bankrupt. It just puts us out of business. It's as simple as that. Those three factors are unique to the trucking industry and are really having an impact. One of the companies close to home was Consolidated Freightways, that you may be aware of, that went bankrupt last year. That's been a Northwest icon, a mainstay in the trucking industry for over 75 years, and it's no longer. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about highway safety. We're real proud of our record in highway safety. Nationally, fatalities involving trucks have gone steadily down in the last 3 years. In Oregon, our performance has also tracked downwards. Truck at fault accidents have declined from 612 in 1999 to 526 in 2002. There's a number of reasons why our safety performance is improving. We've formed some real strong partnerships with our insurance companies. Obviously, safety is one way that we can control the spiraling insurance costs. By reducing our accidents, we're able to control our insurance costs, but what's even more important is the insurance companies are becoming far more picky. Some trucking companies, if they don't have a good safety rating, can't get insurance at all. Or if they can get it, it's so expensive that they can't compete in the marketplace. So the insurance companies are, in effect, putting the less safe trucking companies out of business. Government has also helped significantly improve our safety. A number of years ago, the federal government started a national database that includes all of the truck inspection records, all the violations if we get a ticket or any of that kind of stuff, and all the results from audits that government inspectors do of our companies. Originally, this database was created so we could select, or the government folks could select, the trucking companies that were less safe, and they could take enforcement action against them. But in the last several years, they have put this database on the web. So now it's available to everybody. And the insurance companies are using it for underwriting purposes, and our shippers are using it to choose which carriers or trucking companies they're going to do business with. So that has had an impact on the safety of our operations. Oregon Department of Transportation's Motor Carrier Division also has a very robust safety regulatory program, which we strongly support. They have the reputation of being a leader in this country. They're one of the first state agencies that recognized that it wasn't equipment failures that were causing highway accidents. It was the actions of the driver. And they changed the emphasis in their safety program from truck inspections to dealing with the driver, which has been very positive. We also contribute directly to highway safety through our Highway Watch program. Oregon was one of the first states in the nation to engage in the Highway Watch program. The other states are starting to follow. About 3 years ago, we created a partnership with OSP. And what they do is OSP trains our drivers in how to recognize situations on the highway, and more importantly, how to report it so that it's valuable information to state to the police. State police created an 800 system that bypasses the 911 system. When our drivers call in, they go right into OSP's dispatch. And they recognize all kinds of incidents on the highway. Matter of fact, the first day that we started this program, one of our Highway Watch drivers was leaving the press conference at the Woodburn Port of Entry, and there was a gentleman that had a heart attack, and his car went off the side of the road. The Highway Watch driver called it in, and they were able to get emergency services to him in time to save his life. And that was the first day. It's been a very, very positive program. OSP loves it because they get good, solid, reliable information from these drivers, and they're all over the state all the time. So we're sort of becoming the eyes and ears of the police agencies. Since September 11, we've added a security component, so our drivers are now trained in what to look for in terms of security. And soon we expect to add an Amber Alert component. Oregon's just bringing up their Amber Alert program. An area that where you can have the most impact on highway safety is on education of automobile drivers and how to share the road with trucks. AAA Foundation did a very robust national study. The results came out last year. And one of their conclusions was that 75% of the time when trucks and cars collide, it's the fault of the car driver. The trucking industry has developed a number of programs. We have Share the Road with the Truck programs. We have programs that identify the blind spots around a truck. And we go to the media right before holidays, and we share this in, this kind of information with the media, which they put on the news, and it's real positive. If we could get that information out more broadly and incorporate it in education programs, I think that we would be able to have a fairly significant impact on highway safety. Highway use taxes. This is one of those arcane subjects that nobody in their right mind really wants to talk about. But it's very important to us. Oregon is very unique in how it deals with highway use taxes. You heard earlier from Roger that we have a constitutional provision where we have a dedicated highway fund. All taxes on the ownership or operation of vehicles go into the highway fund, and that money can only be spent on construction and maintenance and administration for our highway system. A lot of states supplement their highway fund dollars with general fund dollars. Right now, I'm really happy that we have a dedicated highway fund given the condition of the general fund. But each state does it differently. In 1999, at the request of the trucking industry, we actually amended that provision of the Constitution. And what we did is we said that the state needs to conduct a study every 2 years to determine how much light vehicle share is for the cost of the roads, how much heavy vehicles. That study then goes to you, and you're to balance the books between the two of us. In reality, Oregon has been doing what are called cost allocation studies longer than any other state. The first study we did was in 1937. We have done more studies than any other state. We've done more studies than the federal government. Part of what happens in these studies is the administrative costs are passed along to the various groups. Trucking, we pay our full share, for example. We pay the full cost of the motor carrier division, including the truck safety program. It's all charged to the trucking industry, which is appropriate. The most recent studies in 1999 and 2001 determined that the trucking industry's share was 36% and that we were paying 36%. So the books were balanced and there weren't any adjustments. 2002, ending in December, we paid about $205 million in Oregon highway use tax. And, of course, we paid a substantial amount also to the federal government. Part of the difference in our system are the type of taxes that we use. Autos pay their fair share in gas taxes and car registration fees, and that's really what we talk about all the time. However, heavy trucks, those over 26,000 pounds, we don't pay a fuel tax. We pay registration fees, which are fairly modest in comparison to other states, but we pay the weight mile tax. Quite frankly, we hate the weight mile tax. And it's one of those issues that is underlying everything that we do. One of the reasons that we hate the weight mile tax is it's so costly to administer. I've attached to my testimony a chart that came out of the most recent cost allocation study that was presented to the 2001 legislature. What it shows is that the cost for collecting highway use taxes from all users was $36,873. It cost $8,906. I'm sorry, $8 million. I'm slipping a digit here. $8,906,000 to collect taxes from cars and light trucks, and light trucks are between 8,001 and 26,000 pounds. And it cost $27,967,000 to collect taxes from heavy trucks, which are between 26,001 and up. So it's costing three times as much to collect taxes from heavy trucks, and heavy trucks are basically only providing a third of the revenue. This seems to us to be out of whack. Now, this is the cost of government. As an industry, we bear similar cost in paying and reporting the tax.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. Mr. Russell, this is a two-part question. First is, obviously you prefer, based on your testimony, the use of a fuel tax versus the weight mile tax. if I'm hearing you correctly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, that is correct.
And what, as far as the amount of dollars that would be generated via a fuel tax versus the weight mile, I don't see any information on that. Can you illuminate us on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, because of the constitutional amendment that requires the study and the balancing between light vehicles and heavy, we would provide our fair share, irregardless of the tax type.
So you would just back it up. You would figure out what the costs are and then just back it up. And then one follow-up. So you're saying that the administrative costs would be a lot less if it was a gas tax, so to speak, for trucks. Do you have numbers on what your estimated cost for that would be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, there were extensive numbers generated during the 99 session when the legislature actually repealed Oregon's weight mile tax and replaced it with the diesel fuel tax. That particular measure was tied with a significant gas tax increase as well. And at the time that it went before the voters, we had the highest gas costs of any time in the history of the state, and that measure went down in flames, big time. So subsequent to that, and the American Trucking Association sued the state of Oregon, claiming that the weight mile tax violated the federal constitution. Last January, the trial court basically indicated or ruled against the American Trucking Association. That case is on appeal right now. We are looking to the court to make that decision. We would expect a decision late summer or early fall. My guess is you're not going to have to look at the repeal of the weight mile tax unless that decision comes out while you're still in session.
One last follow-up. I understand that, and thanks for walking us through that history, because I certainly remember that controversial measure. But I'm trying to figure out, and I'm sure you have the numbers for this, and maybe not off the top of your head, but if the cost you're saying now is about three times the cost for trucks that it is for cars, if you converted from the weight mile to the fuel tax, would that reduce your costs significantly? I mean, you're saying that it would... It's actually the administration that it sounds like is one of the things that you're most concerned about. So I'm trying to get a sense of if the court ruled in your favor, what those administrative costs would look like under the fuel tax.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, one of the reasons that we were more than happy to support the 5-cent increase in the gas tax, which had a corresponding increase in truck taxes, was because of the reduction in the administrative costs. And this is what it costs government, but when you add what it cost us to comply with the weight mile system, we actually felt like we came out ahead. And a 5-cent gas tax increase is about $250 million a year in increased revenue, or in that neighborhood.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative, as we get further in the session, I'm going to need some additional information on this, and I'm certain I'll get it. But is it basically the cost of accounting that the truckers and the trucking industry has to do that makes the increased cost so much, and then the audit on behalf of the state to verify those? Is that the cost?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, absolutely. As I started talking about this subject, I said Oregon is unique. There are national systems that have been established by Congress to deal with the collection of diesel fuel taxes and truck registration fees. There are huge efficiencies from the states working together to deal with this industry that operates in all states. Because Oregon doesn't have a diesel fuel tax, we cannot participate in that system, and that we have to essentially go it alone. For example, in order to collect the weight mile tax, Oregon has to send auditors all over North America, Canada, and in all of the states. Soon they'll have to send auditors into Mexico. Under the International Fuel Tax Agreement, which is the system for collecting fuel taxes, each state audits only their own carriers. They don't have to travel, and they do it on behalf of all the other states. So just from that point alone, you can see the increases in efficiency. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, we do have an appointment with you tomorrow, and we will be happy to provide you with additional information on this subject.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Tow Truck Association. Bob's done a wonderful job of giving you the impact over the in terms of the state and the industry on this system. I represent tow trucks, and a lot of my group are small mom-and-pop operations. And I mean this sincerely. Every one of my group can tell you what day of the month they have to go through and fill out the reports, how long it takes them, and how much it costs them. This is a very, very cumbersome system and adds a lot of stress and a lot of time and a lot of dollars to get through it monthly or quarterly, depending on how they choose to report. So when you look at it in terms of a big trucking company that have people to do that, and that's all they do, that's one thing, and that's a huge cost. It has a great impact on a 2-, 3-, or 4-person company who are mainly drivers, and they have one person to do the books. It's an unbelievable system, and we will be glad to bring some of the reports into you and show them to you. It's a very convoluted system. Thank you.
If you maintain 36%, the trucking industry kept their 36% of the cost, or the dollars going into the highway, what tax per gallon would you have to have on diesel to reach that?
Mr. Chairman, for a whole bunch of reasons, the diesel fuel tax rate and the gas tax rate should be the same. So when you do that, what happens with us is we increase our registration fees fairly dramatically. And the reason that you need diesel and gas to be the same is you've got a lot of pickup trucks today that are running on diesel. You've got Mercedes-Benz automobiles that are running on diesel. And if you just did a straight conversion and left our registration fees alone and just converted the weight mile tax, there would be a diesel fuel tax of about 72 cents a gallon. And I don't think that pickup truck folks and Mercedes-Benz owners would like to be paying 72 cents a gallon on the diesel. So you peg the diesel at the same level as gas, and then light vehicle owners, whether they operate gas vehicles or diesel, are treated the same. And then you increase our registration fees. Our registration fees would go up substantially. Right now, they're for an 80,000-pound truck, they're $320. They would go up in the neighborhood of $2,000 to $3,000 per year.
I have one of those diesel pickups, and I don't want to pay 72 cents.
Right.
Fair share.
Mr. Chair, who would oppose the change if we wanted to do what you want us to do?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, certainly in the past, the American Automobile Association has opposed the change, and I have no reason to believe that they've changed their position.
Why would they oppose it? Do they have to pay more, or what's the deal?
That is a question that we have been pondering forever, because they will not have to pay more because of the constitutional amendment. The books will be balanced one way or the other. It doesn't matter what kind of tax that we have. But AAA has continued to oppose the change in tax.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Did you offend him some way, Bob, or anything? Or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, I'm sure my predecessor did.
Fair. Al and then D.
Mr. Chair, I think also, too, part of the argument is everyone wonders if we can replace the revenue that we now generate through weight mile with diesel tax. And we can show them all the charts and the figures that shows that we can, and more, and more. But there's still that doubt within the state bureaucracy, and it's a hard argument to sell in relation to that, even though the figures do prove that we can generate that fund. I think that's another argument that's out there, too, Representative Zahner.
D.
Mr. Chair, for the record, D. Bridge is Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association. I thought I could add just a little bit of personal perspective to this to show the how onerous it is for the people who have to pay this tax, talking about the bookkeeping expense. My daughter is in the trucking business. She's interstate. She has about 30 trucks that travel in the 48 contiguous states. She has an employee, she tells me, that spends half of her time doing Oregon taxes and the other half of her time doing the taxes for the other 47 states. So that's kind of an example of just how hard it is and how much work it takes to keep the records to pay Oregon weight mile taxes.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Greenland.
Thank you, sir. Is this a problem that technology could solve? I understand the technology is emerging all the time. GPS and other tracking things that the trucking companies may want to use for other business purposes. Would that kind of technology eventually solve this problem?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, I believe so. The technology exists today that you could apply to this problem and dramatically reduce the administrative effort. Unfortunately, that technology is still very, very expensive. It's more expensive than the administrative cost of the existing system. But as the cost of that comes down, and we know that technology gets cheaper and cheaper as it's dispersed more broadly into the marketplace, then yes, there's probably a way. There is a couple of different interim committees that were looking at VMT taxes for cars and using technology to collect those taxes. That's quite frankly easier than doing a weight mile tax for trucks and using technology. That it becomes more difficult because you've got weight to deal with as well as distance traveled. And you've also generally got cars are more localized in their area of travel, where we're not. And so you've really got to have a system that can track us nationwide. And that's where you start getting into some fairly significant expense. Someday, it's going to be nice. But that day's quite a ways off, in my opinion.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions?
Well, thank you for all the questions. I'd like to conclude on this subject by saying that you can see that we have strong feelings in this area. And it does color our thinking on a lot of different subjects. So it's important for you to understand it. And like I said, we will be by to visit all of you either today or tomorrow. And if you have any additional questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Byer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I know you talk about not liking the weight mile tax, and are you attempting any kind of legislation at this time to deal with that?
Mr. Chairman, no. Representative Byer, no. We are waiting for the decision of the court. Now, that's not to say if there wasn't a wonderful opportunity and a groundswell of support that we wouldn't capitalize on it.
I'm signing the sheet.
Are there any other states who use the weight mile tax?
Mr. Chairman, there are three left besides Oregon. New Mexico still has a weight mile tax, New York and Kentucky. Although all of those states have diesel fuel taxes as well as their weight distance taxes. And their weight distance taxes are a relatively small component of the overall taxation, which makes it easier in some ways. Their systems are also less cumbersome and simpler than Oregon's. But those are the only ones left. At one time, there were 27 states that had weight distance taxes. Okay.
One more quick one. Oregon's new Amber Alert program. What?
Correct. What's Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, the Amber Alert is to deal with, to look out for missing children, those kinds of things. We're just bringing our Amber Alert program up. Again, our Highway Watch program and the trucking industry being the eyes for law enforcement is a perfect fit. And what it requires is right now,
for the things that we do for Highway Watch and for national security, we call OSP. And they need to, under the Amber Alert program, they need to call us and tell us what to look for if someone's missing or those kinds of things. The technology is in existence. It hasn't been implemented as of yet. We're still working on that. But Oregon's program is also relatively new.
Thank you, Bob. Bob, but the new equipment that the trucking industry has out there now, their vans are those high cube vans that are 53 foot in length. In my area, like on Highway 20 and Georgia Pacific, moving freight into and out of that area, they can't run them over Highway 20 because they can't make the corners. And so they have to go on the Great Circle route to get out of there. It runs up about 150 miles extra on every load going in and out of there, and the proportional amount of cost. Do these kind of conditions exist other places in the state, Jim?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. And the conditions that you're describing are getting nothing but worse, and it's because of the next subject that I would like to cover with you, and that is the condition of our bridges. We have a huge and unique problem with our highway system, and it is the condition of our bridges. We have hundreds of bridges on the state, county, and local road systems that are failing. There are a number of contributing factors to the failures of these bridges, but the principal one is the design that was employed many, many years ago when these bridges were built. The bridge girders were poured in place in Oregon, and at the time, they were constructed with an approved design. However, in 1955, the Air Force was using a similar design to make concrete girders for hardened battlements to protect their jets. And one of the Air Force engineers says, "You know, I think this design is deficient. That if we use this design, we may get what is called shear cracking." And the engineers all looked at the design and said, got a point. Well, the design was revised, and it added 60% more steel in the girders. And Oregon's bridges were all built before this new design came out. And guess what? We got a lot of shear cracking in our bridges is the problem. A lot of the other states did not use this poured-in-place design. They went to pre-stressed girders, which are poured off-site, and the steel is under tension when the concrete is poured. And so Oregon is unique in the problem. Washington has got 36 bridges like this. Idaho's got 6, and California's got 2. And we've got 555 plus of this type of bridge that's failing. ODOT discovered the problem about 2 years ago. Since that time, our routes of travel have been significantly impeded. It's not affecting the movement of automobiles, but it certainly is affecting the movement of trucks. At least it's not affecting the movement of automobiles in most cases. And the bridge problem already is having a significant impact on Oregon's economy, on our general safety, and the livability of our communities. For example, today the heaviest trucks, what we call heavy haul, cannot use Interstate 84 and I-5. When we go south, north and south, we're using Highway 97 and 26 over Mount Hood to go that way. When we're going east and west, we're going 26, 97, and then Highway 20 to go eastbound. In a lot of instances, this is creating detours that are hundreds of miles. We were talking about what that cost a few minutes ago. That's having a significant impact on the economy already. An example of where safety has been a problem, there was a bridge. We've only had one so far. And that they had to reduce the weight allowed on that bridge to such an extent
that firefighting equipment couldn't use it. There was a fire truck that got stopped. They finally let him go over. But it was also in the middle of all of our forest fires. So we had all of the forest firefighting equipment that had to detour around this bridge. Now, that particular bridge has since been destroyed, and there's a new bridge. I mean, it was in that bad of condition. In terms of the livability of our communities, when we've got a bridge problem, and then we look for a detour route. Riddle, Oregon is a perfect example. It was one of the first bridges that went down on Interstate 5. And the detour route was right downtown through Riddle. And before the detour, they were experiencing 4 trucks a day on Main Street. After the detour, they were experiencing 1,500 trucks a day on the detour. And that definitely has an impact on the livability of a community. The department has been working for a number of months on a plan to address this problem. And it's in what they're calling the Bridge Options Report. We have been working very closely with them. I think you'll find that the Bridge Options Report is an excellent document. I think they've done an outstanding job in coming up with a reasonable, credible solution to this problem. However, as you might imagine, the price tag is pretty hefty. When I came down to Salem for this session, my member said, we have two great fears about this legislative session. The first fear that we have is that we won't get a highway use tax increase, so that ODOT won't be able to fix the bridges, and so the bridges are going to continue to get posted, and we're not going to be able to operate in this state. That's our number one fear. Our number two fear is that we're going to get a tax increase, and it's so big that because of the financial condition of the trucking industry, it's going to put a lot of our struggling members out of business, and we're not going to be able to operate because we're in bankruptcy. The trick for all of us, obviously, is to take some middle ground and figure out a way to keep a healthy trucking industry so that we have a healthy economy, and at the same time address what, in transportation terms, is the biggest crisis that's faced our state since I've been involved. And I came to Oregon in 1980. Finally, I'd like to thank you very much for the opportunity for us to sort of give you an overview of the trucking industry and our issues. I'd be remiss if I didn't recognize ODOT. Obviously, because of what we do, we work very closely with them. Director Warner has been here almost 2 years. He opened his door to the trucking industry. We have learned a lot from one another about each other's issues. We spent a lot of time just talking about ODOT's issues and the trucking industry's issues. That's been a very positive working relationship. I'd also like to recognize Greg Delpani, who's the deputy director in charge of the motor carrier program. He is a very fair-minded regulator, which is a good part of his responsibility. But he's also a very good steward of our resources because we're the ones that pay the entire bill. Finally, I'd like to say that the three of us are very proud to represent the trucking industry, not only for its contribution to our economy and to highway safety, but because we have lots of people in the trucking industry that are part of the vital fabric of all of Oregon's communities. That concludes my testimony, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Representative Avery.
Two very quick questions. And you may better cover this when we have our appointment, and I look forward to that. But your testimony said that it was discovered in 1955 that the basic bridge construction was flawed, but we didn't find in Oregon evidence or discover that problem until 2 years ago. That's 45 years or better. And do we know why it didn't appear for 45 years as being a problem?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, you know, we think sort of that when we build a bridge, it's going to be there forever. That's not the case. Bridges, like any other asset, deteriorate. as they have deteriorated, and they have deteriorated at a faster pace than we would have expected them to. And when ODOT started looking into it, they traced it back to this design problem. Now, there are other contributing factors, certainly, but I think that the design itself is by far the most significant of what's caused the problem. And when I talk with my folks, they said, immediately they get angry. You know, what are we going to do here? We got all these broken bridges, and whose fault is it? Well, whosever fault it is long since passed away. So let's move on and figure out how we're going to fix it.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair. And I guess the immediate thing that comes to my mind is it because of the increased weights that we're seeing, and not to place fault, but you know, is that a contributing factor? Which leads me to my next question, which, you know, you said today the heaviest trucks are prohibited from using I-5 and I-84, and I traveled those roads to and from my district, and you know, yesterday coming over, I saw a number of trucks that were, you know, 28-wheelers, I guess, 105,000 pounds or more. My question being, if they're traveling I-84, how heavy are the ones that are not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, these are very good questions. Yes, I would say that part of the problem with the bridges is the increased truck weights. Nationally, we used to be at 72,000 pounds. Now we're at 80,000 pounds. How big a contributing factor that is, I don't know. From our point of view, we tend to be fairly simplistic in how we look at things. We look at the surrounding states, and we say, do they have a problem? And no, they don't have a problem. How heavy are trucks in those states? Well, with the exception of California, they're as heavy, if not heavier, than they are in Oregon. So then we say, well, is it really weight? I'm sure that weight played a role, but it is not the most significant factor by any means. When you look at the states west of the Mississippi, in terms of truck weights, Oregon is right smack in the middle at 105.5 that we routinely allow. Now, we have this thing called the heavy haul industry that most people are not aware of and don't pay much attention to. And these are the folks that transport houses, and they transport the large transformers that go to our dams, for example, that can weigh 250,000 pounds or better. All of these kinds of things that go into our factories. We have had loads on Oregon highways that are almost 1 million pounds. And now... when I say that, that doesn't mean that you put it on an 18-wheeler and you run it across the bridge. any load over 105.5, actually 98,000 if it's heavy haul, they're specifically routed by ODOT and local government. So there's a route plan, and all those things are taken into consideration. In some instances, we build a bridge over the bridge so that that one load can move, then we remove that bridge. There's all kinds of things like that that we do. We have some of the best heavy haulers in the country right here in Oregon. And this is it's a very sophisticated part of our industry here.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Greenwood.
Yes, sir. Thank you. The I-5 corridor is pretty important to my district with the Northwest industrial neighborhood and the port and other things. Are you going to have a formal position on that I-5 corridor report? Are you going to be working that one in some particular?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, we were pleased with the I-5 corridor report that it had provisions for trucking and for freight movement, if that answers your question. Is that the answer to all of our freight mobility problems? No. Were we frustrated by the process to some degree? Yes. So, I mean, we feel about 99 different ways about that thing. But I'd be happy to talk to you about that in depth.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Dee, you didn't get your fair share of the time. Do you have some additional comments?
I only have a very small part to add here. For the record, Dee Bridges, I'm the executive director of the Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association. We're the log truckers and the chip truckers and lumber and veneer and plywood truckers. Been around for about 40 years. We were formed in 1961 in Pendleton. One time our membership was as high as 700 members, but as the timber industry, decline in the timber industry has taken its toll over the years, it's also taken its toll on our membership, and we're now down to about 300 and barely hanging on by our fingernails. Forest Products truckers face all the economic problems that Bob just talked about. We've got high insurance costs, maybe even higher insurance costs. Our fuel costs are even higher than the average highway truck. We don't get as good a fuel mileage as they do. We're climbing around on logging roads and get very poor mileage up there, so fuel costs impact us even heavier. So we've got all these expenses, and in addition to all of that, there's a lingering depression or recession in the timber industry in this state has impacted us even further. We've got, any time a mill is shut down or there's a layoff of any kind, it has a dramatic effect on my guys. I like to say, if they're not logging it, we're not hauling it. And I've got many of my members who just have their trucks parked waiting for jobs. And a lot of them have just simply gone out of business. The industry tends to be, log trucking industry tends to be older in age, the members in it, and some of them just can't fight it any longer. They're in their 60s or whatever, and they just park the truck and start drawing Social Security. So that has an impact on us, a very bad impact on us, and it's just something that I'd like to have you all remember as you wade through all of the bills that are becoming for you during this session. We are hanging on by the skin of our teeth, and we really can't afford much more bad news. Thank you.
Is there any questions, indeed? Al, do you have some closing
comments? Yes, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Tow Truck Association. We echo everything that Bob has said. We are a unique industry and have a couple of issues that are ongoing that we're working on daily as we speak. One of them is with DEQ on the material that we can pick up at the scenes of accidents. We visited that before the legislature and need to revisit it. So I may be bringing this issue before you at some time. But DEQ has extended their hand and are helping us work through this problem. And so I may be bringing that issue and another one related to some aero board issues that we have with ODOT. So you'll be seeing me again in the future. Thank you very much for your attention today.
Okay. Any other questions? Don't look like it. Thank you, gentlemen, for a very good report.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I want to open the hearing on House Bill 2214. Janet, you want to give us a brief explanation of the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Good morning, members. House Bill 2214 is a bill at the request of the Department of Transportation and would authorize the use of hardship driving permits to drive to and from drug treatment and to drive to and from a person driving to and from seeking employment. Hardship permits, as you'll hear from Kelly in more detail, allow qualified persons who have suspended driver licenses to drive for specified purposes. Already under current law, they can drive to and from work and to and from alcohol programs and medical treatment, among other things. House Bill 2214 would add drug treatment, so they could, similar to the alcohol treatment that's under current law, to drug treatment and to seek employment as well as to drive to or from a job. It would add those two things to the list of eligible purposes of driving. And just wanted to point out that the exact same change is made in five different ORS sections, but they're all similar. This change is similar. Some of them the judge has to okay. Some of them the department okays. All of them come with conditions, hours of driving, sometimes routes. But each section of statute is, there's some general ones about hardship permits, and there's some more specific ones related to different types of violations that result in the suspension for driving. So I just wanted to point out that's why it's done so many times, and there's five sections of the bill. Some of the wording changes are just legislative council changing shalls to mays, and it doesn't have any substantive change in the bill. Changing a shall not to a may not, for instance, in the first page of the bill. So you'll see a number of those as well. And that's all I have to say, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Kelly?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation, and Janet summed it up quite nicely. I kind of feel like Al Elkins. I could just say ditto what, you know, Janet said. He said, you know, I echo what Bob said. House Bill 2214 is a bill that we asked to be introduced, recognizing that, you know, just trying to bring the hardship permit statutes up to today's world, which is people seeking employment and people going through substance abuse programs, which, you know, drug treatment, which could be, whether it be controlled substances or inhalants or anything. I've talked with the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse. They're the ones who have the programs, and they say drug treatment programs covers a wide variety of substance abuse problems. It isn't just drugs per se. It can also cover inhalants that are in the statutes also. And people, as you know, are unfortunately going in and out of jobs, and so to allow someone to legally drive to seek employment is an important thing. I will mention that on a hardship permit, one of the things that is good about knowing a person's on a hardship permit is they have filed proof of insurance with the department in order to get that. So you do know that they have insurance. If they drive without a hardship permit, they are driving while suspended and they are driving without insurance. So it is a good thing to encourage a person to be monitored on a hardship permit. And for the seek employment, they, you know, would be limited to number of hours per day, et cetera. So I would ask the committee to support the bill. I think it's a good one in bringing it up to today's world standards, you know, the reality of life.
Thank you, Kelly. Any questions? Okay. Don't look like there's any. Thank you, Kelly. The Dash 1 amendments, are they yours?
Mr. Chair, when Janet and I met and talked about the bill, she asked if it would be a good thing to have what we thought about an emergency clause. Frankly, we hadn't thought about it. Whenever I read this language, I think, oh, gosh, you know, immediate preservation of the public safety. I think, gosh, I don't know if it meets that standard. But I'll tell you the truth, this would help people right away. And it would be probably a good thing to have an emergency clause because, you know, people are trying to go to substance abuse programs today and they're trying to seek employment today. So the sooner we could make the changes, the better it would be. We would appreciate it if you added the emergency clause.
Thank you, Kelly. With that there, I think we can close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2214. Is there any motion?
Mr. Chair?
Anything on it?
I move House Bill 2214 be amended with the Dash 1 amendments.
Representative Dingfelder moves that House Bill 2214, the Dash 1 amendments be to 2214 be amended. Is there any objection? Hearing none, they're adopted. Through the motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2214 to the floor with a few past recommendation.
Representative Dingfelder moves House Bill 2214 to the floor with Dash 1 with a due pass recommendation. Those in favor of the motion will signify by aye. Opposed, nay. Please call the roll.
Byers.
Aye.
Dingfelder.
Aye.
Greenlick.
Aye.
Gilman.
Excuse.
Mabry.
Aye.
Zahn.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Just have carriers. Is there someone that would like to carry the bell on the floor?
I'll volunteer.
Dingfelder will carry the bell for us. Thank you. Open public hearing on House Bill 2261. And,
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2261 would clarify that installation of an ignition interlock device may occur after the end of a suspension or revocation for conviction of driving while suspended under the influence of intoxicants or DUII. Current statute requires that an ignition interlock device be installed on a person's vehicle in order for the person's license to be reinstated after a suspension or revocation for conviction of DUI. The requirement applies for 6 months following the end of the suspension. If you have any questions about ignition interlock, if you don't know what they are, we can cover that when Kelly's up here. The Attorney General advised DMV that the wording of the statute requires the agency to have proof of installation of the device prior to the end of the suspension, and 2261 would clarify that the person can get the device any time after the suspension. They wouldn't be able to drive until they get it, but they wouldn't have to have it done before the suspension is over. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jim.
There's also an emergency clause for your consideration on this bill.
Kelly, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. This is another bill that the department requested, and I've spoken to, I think, most of you on this. And what this bill does is clarify back what we believe the intent was, and I've talked with some of the folks in state police who worked on the original ignition interlock device bill when it came through, and that was the intent for the interlock device, IID, I'm going to call it for short. Everybody loves acronyms. The intent was to have the IID be the carrot. If when your DUI with suspension was up, if you got the IID in your car, you got your full privileges back. And that is how we operated for quite some years. Even if the six-month suspension had started, maybe a month down the road, you got the IID installed. When you gave us a certificate showing that it had been installed, you got your full privileges back. And it was only recently that, as Janet said, you know, one of the assistant attorney generals looked at the law and said, it's not quite as clear that way. I think you have to not allow full reinstatement unless they have the IID in the car before the DUI suspension ends. And so the carrot sort of went away. And so what we're suggesting in this bill would be clarified. Now, a couple of you have asked what the cost is, and I had somebody call the Guardian Interlock Company. It's about $70, $75 a month while you have it in your car. And I also had somebody ask me if somebody else could blow into the device for them. And that used to be a problem, but apparently the technology has evolved that if I were to get one installed, they calibrate it to my breath. And if a friend were to try to blow into it, it would start the car, but after 20 minutes, the car would stop. So unless that friend wants to keep driving around with me and blowing into the car for 20-minute intervals, it's not going to be a whole bunch of good. So I just wanted to know. I checked on that. So anyway, we believe that it'd be good to restore the original intent back into the program. This is a good thing for someone to have, to be able to have the incentive for full privileges and to be monitored by the machine to make sure that they aren't drinking and driving. We would ask the committee to support the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Ningo.
I have two questions for Kelly. First is, what percentage of DUIIs actually do install this device, number one? And then two, when Troy came in front of the committee, we heard that actually DUIIs were going down, but the incidence of driving under the influence of drugs was going up. And is there some sort of a a device that would apply to somebody under the influence of drugs. I mean, I don't know if the technology is there, but, you know, and I'm sure it would depend on the drug. But just clarify that this would only apply to people under the influence of alcohol.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I'm sorry I don't have the statistics for you today. I will be happy to get them to Janet and to you so that the committee will know how many people are using IIDs after DUI. All DUI suspensions are required to have the IID. That is one of the things in statute. So any DUI has a six-month, after that suspension, has a six-month period following it for an IID. I don't know how many people take advantage of it. I apologize for not having that today. And, yes, you're right. This only measures alcohol in the breath. It does not do drugs.
Okay, thank you.
You got a question, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly, does it have to be zero alcohol that's detected, or is there a level? I forgot to ask this earlier.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Adkins, thank you. It will register any amount of alcohol and will not allow the car to start. You can have no alcohol in your breath. I had them check on that, too.
Representative Greenland.
Kelly, would you explain about the 6 months? Why the 6 months is whether or not begins whether or not they have it in. Is that what the statute?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, what the statute says is a DUI suspension will last either a year or 3 years. Your first one lasts for a year, your second and subsequent last for 3 years. And what the law says is at the end of that suspension period is a 6 month period in which your license will continue to be suspended unless you get an interlock device in your car. So you could continue on a hardship permit like you had in your DUI suspension and not get the interlock device, but you wouldn't have full privileges back. In order to regain full privileges, you must have the IID in that six-month period following the DUI. One of the other requirements is that you have a treatment certificate showing that you went through alcohol treatment. So there are several things in the law. This is one of them.
Any other questions? Hearing none. Kelly, thank you again. That's all we have. With that, I'll close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2261. Is there a motion? Representative Johnson.
Do we have a dash one with this?
Yes, we do.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2261 to be amended with the dash one amendments.
Representative Zahner moves the dash one amendments to 2261. Is there any objections? Without objections, so done. And another motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2261 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Zahner.
Amended.
As amended. Representative Zahner moves House Bill 2261 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Those in favor of the motion signify by aye. Opposed, nay. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Greenland.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Excused.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Need a carrier.
Has he done one yet?
Mm-hmm.
No volunteers?
Well, I'll do it.
Representative Beyer will carry it to the floor for us. Thank you. And with that, I believe our business certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When Troy Casales was before the committee last week, someone asked for a copy of the information that has each county about DUI control and performance standards. And so he brought a publication for everyone. You can look up your county if you want to. If you don't want these, just leave them at your place, and we'll return them to ODOT if you don't want to take one with you. Or you can give it back to us later if you look up what you need. And Friday we have another field trip.
Yes.
And you've been excused from floor session from 4 Friday. We don't know what time floor session will be on Friday, but...
What time are we planning on leaving here then?
8 o'clock.
And at the weigh station?
Uh-huh. And what, so let us know if you're going to drive there yourself. If you want to meet here, it will be at 8 o'clock.
Mr. Chair,
for
the people coming from Portland or from that area, they should just pull off at Woodburn and come right across and stop at that Shell station there, because that's where we're going to meet the rest of you coming in. They don't want to drive all the way in.
And what time is that going to be at? 8:30 or
something? Probably
about 8:30 should be at the weigh station. If it's an 8:30 floor session, could we leave after it again like we did last time? Do you know whether they're thinking about an 8:30 floor session?
I don't know that, and we can find out. But
it'd be very much my preference to do that.
Get you back. It'll get you back that much later in the afternoon too.
Like
well, I
don't know whether they got any bills scheduled for the floor yet or not.
I know there's some for Wednesday and Thursday. I don't see. We don't know about Friday. So. Right.
If there are bills, I'd really rather try and arrange to be here for it. Early in my term, I'd be missing votes.
Vote by cell phone.
By cell phone. There you go.
Okay, I guess we can check on that.
I don't know if they've decided, but we'll find out.
Thank you. All right. Any other comments? Not without objection, we're adjourned.
Or even with
Thank
objection.
You. Yeah,
who cares? We're adjourned.